Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and 5 years ago today, FDIC Chair Sheila Bair was having a very, very busy day as financial services firm Lehman Brothers had announced billions of dollars in losses. The government was trying to figure out if and how to bail them out, and the world was trying to figure out the new normal of credit default swaps, government bailouts, and economic Armageddon. It seems both like just yesterday and some sort of fever dream from long, long ago, doesn't it? Sheila Bair left the administration in 2011 and is now a senior advisor to the Pew Charitable Trusts. Her most recent book is now out in paperback. It's called Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself. Sheila Bair, thanks for coming on around this September 15th anniversary. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
And can I start by asking if we're celebrating, or celebrating is the wrong word, but if we're marking the right big anniversary here, the day the government did not bail out Lehman Brothers?
Oh, good question.
Is that the right starting point anniversary of the financial crisis?
I think it's more symbolic of just how fragile the financial system was, that, you know, a $600 billion institution, which granted is big, but in the size of our economy and financial sector, was not a huge presence. But nonetheless, even their failure triggered this worldwide meltdown. And I think that says a lot about how fragile the financial system was, how much work needs to be done, still needs to be done, to make it a stable, resilient system. So I do, from that perspective, I do think it's good to look back and see what happened.
I heard former Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, interviewed the other day saying they didn't bail out Lehman because they had no legal authority to do so. And now they do, under new laws, if such a thing were needed again. Do they, in your opinion, and if they had bailed out Lehman, how much of the broader economic downturn in jobs and housing that we're all still recovering from could have been avoided?
Well, there's no authority to bail out. Actually, that's specifically prohibited under the Dodd-Frank law. We do have a new government-run bankruptcy. It was essentially a government-run bankruptcy process, a bankruptcy process which is run by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, my old agency, as receiver, when these large financial institutions get into trouble. And this will deal with the systemic disruptions that a traditional bankruptcy process creates, mainly because bankruptcy is a full stop. So, you know, financial institutions, they need financing for their assets. Their assets are financial. So once the financing stops, which it does in a traditional bankruptcy, the institution just falls apart. And under the FDIC's traditional procedures, the FDIC has the authority to continue essential operations of the financial institutions while putting the losses on the shareholders and unsecured creditors, which we didn't have that authority prior to Dodd-Frank. We have it now. But it's a very tough process. The shareholders and the unsecured creditors, the bondholders, not taxpayers, take the risk. And also the top management, automatically they all lose their jobs and are subject to a 3-year clawback of compensation. So it's a quite punitive process we have now. And yes, I do believe it will work. I do believe it does end bailouts. But it is also a process that can protect the larger economy, the innocent bystanders, from the failure of very large financial institutions.
So is that part of Dodd-Frank? And you'd say that bill, at least to the extent you just described, really has changed the landscape and will protect the country better in the future?
I think it has. It's untested, but my former agency has done a lot of work with the Federal Reserve to put the we've got the rules in place for it. The FDIC has been very public about the strategies they will use. Very clear that bondholders and shareholders will take the losses as appropriate. And I think it's important for those who want to invest in banks or buy their debt to understand that their money is at risk. There's no government backstop for them, and they need to do their due diligence and make sure they understand the risk the bank is taking before they invest in them.
So, listeners, if you want to get in and say something or ask a question of the former FDIC chair, Sheila Bair, around this fifth anniversary of the Lehman Brothers collapse, September 15th, 2008, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you think the country has learned the lessons that we needed to learn, or anything you want to ask Sheila Bair, looking back to that time or looking at where we are today or look forward? 212-433-WNYC, 433-WNYC, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And to keep looking back for just a minute, if they had bailed out Lehman, how much of the broader economic downturn in jobs and housing and everything do you think would have been avoided? There are people who wring their hands and say, oh, if they had only bailed out Lehman.
Well, I think the sudden shock and kind of the domino effect, and especially the reserve fund breaking the buck, which is a money market fund, and which precipitated a run on money funds and, again, required another bailout program. There are some aspects of the freezing up of the financial system that would have been avoided. But we still had even if we bailed out Lehman, it wouldn't have stopped. The taxpayers still would have had to bail out a lot of other sick institutions because they had too little capital, meaning that they had used too much borrowed money to fund themselves. And just like whether it's a business or a household or a bank, if you borrow too much money, more than you can afford to pay back, based on the value of the assets that you have, you have a significant problem. So we had too much leverage, too many banks with too much leverage, too many banks that had invested in very complex, esoteric mortgage-backed instruments that were rapidly losing value. So we were still going to have problems, and we still would have had to have government intervention, which is quite sad, I think, that it had gotten to that point. And again, so I think what the regulators need to do is make sure that we have enough of a stable system that this doesn't happen again. But I don't think the regulatory reforms are quite where they need to be yet.
And you've cited other positive developments since then, greater capitalization requirements for banks, moving derivatives trading onto central markets, increased right. mortgage standards. You want to talk a little more about the higher capital requirements? In other words, if a bank starts to collapse, it now is likely to have more money on hand to either avoid failure or not need the taxpayers to step in.
Right.
Has that actually been set in law, or have banks actually learned their lesson about that? I'm not sure.
No, I don't think they have. I think capital ratios, that is the ratio of the shareholder equity that funds the bank's operations, those levels have increased a bit, but not nearly as much as they should. We have more capital in the banks, but not nearly as much. I think, if you look at all their off-balance sheet risks, their percentage of capital to the total exposures is just around 4%, which is quite low. Even if you take the off-balance sheet off, it doesn't go up that much. And we need to get a lot more capital into the banks. The regulators have proposed some fairly tough, they should be tougher, but some fairly tough rules, something called the leverage ratio, which would bring that ratio up to 6% for banks, 5% for financial conglomerates. I think that's counterintuitive. I think the number should be higher for financial conglomerates. But that would bring about another $90 billion into the banking system. I would like to see that number be set at a minimum of 8%, or if not higher. And we're going to be a group that I had called the Systemic Risk Council is going to be advocating for a higher number. Some of the banks, like Wells Fargo, are already at 8%. But ironically, the ones that have big derivatives and trading operations, they're really the ones that have a lot of leverage. And that is bad because they can have very sudden losses on the securities and derivatives. With loans, if your model is to make loans, those are not what's called mark-to-market, so the losses are gradual over time. They accumulate. You have time to try to work with the borrower to mitigate losses. But with securities and derivatives operations, they're all mark-to-market or fair-valued, which means the losses on them can be very sudden. Mm. And the banks that have those big operations have the less amount of capital.
Sheila Bair, former FDIC chair and author of Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself. And RJ in Prospect Heights, you're on WNYC. Hello, RJ.
Hi there. I just wanted to thank Commissioner Bair for the extraordinary work that she did during the time she was in office for the consumer in the hundreds of banks that she rescued the small ones all around the country. I don't think this is very well known or talked about. And also, I believe she recommended that similar actions should be done with the so-called too-big-to-fail banks, and I wish people had paid more attention to her on that.
Well, thank you. That's always nice to hear. I do appreciate that, I am very proud of the work that the agency did. And as I argue in my book, I think we could have imposed more accountability. We had to do something. I've never questioned that we didn't have to do something to stabilize the system, but we were quite generous in the bailout programs, regrettably so. And Dodd-Frank has ended that now, but I did try to curb them back, and I appreciate your recognition of those efforts as well.
And RJ,
the small banks, for the most part, stayed healthy during the crisis.
RJ, thank you very much. And Ben in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ben.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I'd like to know why the banks didn't have their feet held to the fire when they were allowed to modify mortgages, only those that they felt were owned by Freddie and Fannie, so that the government takes a hit, but the banks were permitted to walk away and say, well, if you're not financed by that, if the mortgage isn't backed by them, we're not going to do anything about it.
Yeah.
You still have to go through, you know, whether it's foreclosure or whatever it is, but that they weren't. And these are banks that were bailed out,
right.
And yet they were allowed to make those kinds of decisions.
It's one of the great injustices, Sheila Bair, that people call about, like Ben, over and over and over and over again, that the lenders, the banks, were bailed out, but the borrowers, families who were taking out mortgages, were allowed to lose their homes in such numbers.
Well, that, and they're right. And again, I have three chapters in my book devoted to our struggles to try to get these some help relief for homeowners who are in distress. And again, like a lot of the programs that helped Main Street, they were very kind of timid and incremental, and it's still a problem. I do think that, you know, that the bondholders need to take some responsibility here. Two, a lot of these mortgages were not on the balance sheets of the big banks. They were held in securitization trusts that backed securities, mortgage-backed securities that were held by bondholders. And the bondholders didn't want to give up their high returns and didn't want to take losses. And so I think that has been was part of the problem when we're trying to get loans modified. And that also continues to be a dynamic in play. And that's been the Wall Street Journal has been doing some coverage of that. So, but the large banks, nonetheless, they service these loans, whether it's for private label securitizations or for Fannie and Freddie, and their track record has just been abysmal. And it's not, you know, it has not been improved except on the margin. People, you know, the regulators should have taken that in hand. As far as I'm concerned, Fannie and Freddie should have cut them off if they didn't improve their servicing standards, but they didn't. Again, we've just been very timid in how we deal with this. And, you know, we're so scared of destabilizing the system or making these big banks take losses that people who need help are not getting help. And there is, again, to go back to the Wall Street Journal's coverage of this, there's a heartbreaking story today of a woman who's been struggling for years with one of these horrible, you know, subprime mortgages. I think her interest rate's like 9%. And she keeps paying that. She's always been current on her mortgage, but she can't refinance into a lower rate because she's underwater. And, again, her mortgage is held in one of these securitization trusts. So it's not fair, and we have not dealt with it decisively. And I think that's one of the great tragedies of this crisis.
And you've written about the need for mortgage lending standards since the banks were allowing and even pushing mortgages on people who really would not have been qualified under any reasonable past, idea of what makes somebody qualified for a loan. But was it more that, or was it more what was done with those mortgages, the packaging and the securitization and the betting against the borrower that made the system so complex and vulnerable?
Well, they're related. Actually, the banks that lent on a portfolio basis and kept the loans on their own books and so, you know, would have to take the losses if the borrower defaulted, those are significantly higher credit quality. And they're serviced better, too, because the bank will take the loss if the borrower defaults. So there's more efforts to help homeowners who are in distress and restructure their loans to keep them paying. But, you know, the securitized loans, these two things are related because once with securitization, we severed the decision to make the loan and fund the loan from the ongoing ownership of the loan and the risk that that loan would default later on.
And that was such an eye-opener when I first learned about this at the beginning of the crisis, that the bank that made the loan then, in many cases, very quickly sold off the loan.
That's right.
And was not responsible if it failed, and therefore they had incentive to push bad loans on too many borrowers.
But they did. They wanted to do as much volume as possible. So they just started making, you know, and this is the mortgage originators. A lot of these mortgage originators are non-banks. I think that's important to make that distinction. Traditional banks, at least initially, were not doing this. This is the Wall Street securitizations were funding these non-bank mortgage originators. But it became a volume-driven business because the people making the loans, originating the loans, were paid up front, and they didn't care. And so they generated as much volume as possible. And for vulnerable people, they gouged them, like this woman in the Wall Street Journal, giving them very high interest rates because that would command a bigger premium once they sold those loans into the market. That's why I'm very disappointed in the regulators for basically backing off on a key part of Dodd-Frank, which is to force the securitizers to keep risk, to make them take some of the losses if those borrowers default later. That will give them more of an interest to making sure that the borrower can afford the loan. But the regulators are backing off on that. I think it's unfortunate.
Looking back, what role do you see, what responsibility should be placed on the individual borrower? Because, you know, we could take calls and comments all day from people who say, yes, everything you say is true about the banks and the regulators, but at the same time, you know if you can't afford a loan.
Yeah.
And so what do you think about that?
I think there is no doubt there were a lot of borrowers that played this, a lot of real estate professionals, professional investors that were buying multiple properties, fibbing on their, if not outlying, committing fraud on their loan application, or the mortgage originator helping them lie about income or about whether, you know, how many houses they owned and whether this is an investment property or not. So there is plenty of blame to go around in the borrower community. That said, though, a good chunk of the subprime loans, and I think you need to distinguish subprime, which were very, very high interest rate loans with very steep payment shocks, very steep prepayment penalties. You have to distinguish those from these option arms or pick-a-pays that were used by professional investors. The subprime were abusive, horribly abusive loans. They were push-marketed, pushed onto more vulnerable segments of our population. We would see instances of mortgage brokers trolling neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods, for people with troubled credit histories who had equity in their home. They were targeted. And the way these mortgages were marketed was misleading. People thought they had fixed-rate mortgages. They didn't understand the payment shock that they would have after a couple of years. They didn't understand the prepayment penalties. So I think you do have to segment the borrower market. Mm-hmm. Yes, there were a good number of borrowers who exploited this and took advantage of it, but there were also some real victims.
Steve, in Plano, Texas, you're on WNYC with former FDIC Chair Sheila Bair. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Ms. Bair.
Hi.
So given the punitive measures that you had mentioned, which were passed in Dodd-Frank, why wouldn't it be immediately a no-brainer to any future CEO to simply circumvent them by putting in an extra clause in their contract, which basically says, in the event of a bailout, you're going to pay me before the bailout three plus years of salary.
I never would put anything past some of these guys, but I think, and they're all guys, by the way, but, you know, I think that would be invalid. I would assume and hope that if these are regulated entities and if somebody tried to pull that, the regulators would move very aggressively against that and invalidate it. This thing only works, and boards need to be aware of this, too. You know, the consequences need to be severe. And I do think, going back to Lehman, I wonder, you know, Lehman had a chance early on to sell itself. There were several financial institutions who were interested in acquiring that franchise, and the head of Lehman decided that, you know, he wasn't going to do that because he thought he was going to get a bailout and his bank was worth more than people were offering. But I think now with this new very harsh process, the bank management will not be and should not be counting on a bailout, and they will have stronger incentives to take their own self-corrective measures to avoid this very harsh process, because if they go into it, it is very harsh. And I have no doubt that the government, even if somebody tried to slip that clause in, would vigorously go after them, at least my old agency would, to claw back their salary and that of their colleagues.
So as we run out of time, you threw in there that this is pretty much all guys.
Right.
Our next guest is going to be Jody Kantor from the New York Times, who has that huge article this week about a gender equity experiment at the Harvard Business School. And I think Elizabeth Warren has made the argument that women are less are more risk-averse than men and make decisions more in a consensus manner. So do you think more women in finance would have prevented the collapse 5 years ago?
Well, I think it would have helped. It's there's lots of research that shows women tend to be more risk-averse than men, and in certain contexts that helps. In other contexts, it may not, but certainly in this context, it would have helped. I think also just breaking up the club, too. There are too many. This is not only is it male-dominated, but it's very insular. They only talk to themselves. And you had this herd mentality. They were all doing the same thing, you know, and there was no outsider coming in and say, you know, wait, let's stop the madness here. So, yeah, I think from the standpoint of breaking up the club, bringing in fresh perspectives, more objective perspectives, and also with a lot of research showing women tend to be a little more risk-averse, I think that absolutely could have helped.
Sheila Bair, former chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, which insures your regular old bank deposits up to a certain pretty high amount, and the author of Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself. Thank you for such a clear-eyed look back on this fifth anniversary or thereabouts of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and look forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And bye-bye. She's now Senior Advisor to the Pew Charitable Trusts. Well, we will talk next to New York Times correspondent Jody Kantor about the massive Class of 13 gender experiment at the Harvard Business School. We'll also hear the new revelations that many more thousands of votes from Tuesday's mayoral primary remain uncounted than we thought there were. And that's coming up after the latest news with Richard Hake. Richard, what you got?